Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. My name is Lori, and today I am joined by Emily, who's going to be sharing a little bit about her story with borderline personality disorder, ADHD, OCD, and substance use, and what treatment has looked like for her. So, Emily, super, super excited to have you on the podcast. I've been following you on Instagram for a long time now, and a fellow Canadian, which is always exciting. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm 27 and I'm from Newfoundland in Canada. Obviously, we're an island and our population is probably just under 525,000. My diagnosis is BPD and ADHD and OCD. And I guess I kind of have always struggled with my mental health. When I was a child, I was incredibly anxious and codependent, but I was also pretty hyperactive, and I had a severe fear of vomit.
No, me yeah, too.
I have emetophobia, and I knew that you had it as well, so I was like, this is gonna be great.
Yes, okay, cool.
But yeah, so as long as I can remember, I've been incredibly afraid of like other people throwing up or myself throwing up, and again, I hope that it's not hard for you to talk about, but I've worked on it a bit.
Oh, I've worked on it lots, but I'm just like, I'm so stoked to have this conversation.
Yes. Yes. So obviously around that, I've always kind of been like a bit anxious of public places. And like, I was very anxious at school. So as a child, like, again, very codependent on my parents and like stayed home a lot, but would like be pushed outside of my comfort zone a bit, which I definitely needed. And then when I hit middle school, it was almost like my mental health kind of just switched. I don't know if it had to do with like adolescence and puberty, but I started having like panic attacks and that fear kind of like amplified. And I never really actually told anybody this was kind of directly what was going on. It was just like, you know, Emily's a bit germy, like afraid of germs.
Yeah, totally.
Or she doesn't like restaurants or public places, you know, she's just, you know, anxious. Because if I felt like nobody would really understand, and it felt like a bit of a silly fear back then.
Totally. Yeah. Well, and it almost like for me, it kind of, the way to describe it for me was like, I almost talked about like agoraphobia, which is like fear of going outside, right? Or like fear of being in public places, because it wasn't actually that fear. It was the fear of throwing up, but the only way I could describe it where people understood was the fear of being around others. Because if I threw up on my own, it would still suck, but I just like could not imagine being around other people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that really amplified in terms of like taking the bus to school, traveling on school trips. Like I missed a lot of that, and just going to school in general. So in grade 7, you know, I kind of refused to go to school, and my parents wouldn't be able to leave even the house because I became so codependent on them. I'd call them and call them. We tried to go on a trip and they were taking me like, I guess, 45 minutes away from our house. And I remember it, you know, distinctively. I was just so panicked because of this fear. And we were driving on the road and stuff. And also, we have to go home, just taking a panic attack. And obviously they wouldn't turn around. They wouldn't go home. They were like, you have to push, you have to get through this kind of thing, exposure. But I just wouldn't. And I actually ended up trying to exit the vehicle and stuff. So yeah,
I used to do the same thing.
Yeah.
No joke.
I was 12 and I was gone. I was jumping out. I couldn't, I was like, I can't die. So panicked, right? Like I can't be here. I need to go home.
Okay. I am like feeling so seen right now. I have never had a conversation with somebody. You're like describing my childhood at that age.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And meanwhile, you know, my sister's there too. I do have a sister. She's lovely. And like, she's always been very patient, but they just didn't understand what was going on. I couldn't explain it. I was young. I was going through emotions and stuff of puberty, et cetera. So they ended up taking me into the emergency room and saying like, this is concerning. We feel like, you know, this is like maybe self-harm behavior. And we were dismissed a good bit for a while. And when I would just refused to go to school, they would try. My dad would sit in the parking lot. He would sit in the cafeteria, you know, like very, very supportive in that way, for sure. I just wouldn't. And eventually another trip to the emergency room, they were like, we're going to refer you to a psychiatrist. So I, at 13, got diagnosed with ADHD and general anxiety disorder. Kind of worked through that a bit in terms of like getting some private counseling, got put on medication back then, which was Paxil, and Concerta, which was just a new medication back then, because I remember my mom was a little hesitant about it. Through that work, I did get back into school. I did a DBT group when I was an adolescent at the gym, which was lovely that, you know, they offered it. It was a very small group, but that experience when I was young was definitely helpful. And I do think that had I not lucked into getting into the system, or if my parents hadn't fought so hard, like me right now, like my outcome may have been a lot different.
The DBT group, were you put in that because of your ADHD and your anxiety, or did you already have a BPD diagnosis?
So I didn't get diagnosed with BPD until I was 18.
Right.
The BPD group was described, or the DBT group was described as something that they were doing because of I was acting out. So at that point in time, in like my younger adolescence, it was more so like anger towards my parents when they wouldn't understand, throwing chairs, you know, and jumping out of vehicles, damage to the house. So this was something that they had just kind of gotten on the go for people who I think they sensed had heightened or dysregulated emotions, you know, or some of these patterns maybe were starting, kind of thing.
That's so cool, because like I'm 2 years older than you. You're 27. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm 2 years older than you. And like, I have all of those issues were the exact same as I was dealing with. I don't have an ADHD diagnosis, but otherwise, like, you know, the car thing, the punching holes in the wall, the breaking everything I can see, throwing chairs, whatever. And I was always referred to like anger management, which wasn't ever actually getting to the emotion dysregulation part. And absolutely. So the fact that like 2 years of difference, and they were kind of figuring out that like emotion regulation and DBT was the way to go. That's so cool.
It was really cool. And honestly, I have nothing but wonderful things to say about my experience in like as a child in terms of the care I got and my psychiatrist and stuff. And again, like I'm not going to sit here and say a bunch of negative things about the adult system that I've been in or experiences, but it has been different. And I think it's super cool too. You know, they gave us like laminated cue cards with flip cards, kind of being like, you sour candies and, you know, your ice cubes. And it was like cute.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's so amazing.
Yeah. That really helped me a lot. And I guess, you know, I continued on through high school, which was fine. And like that stuff helped me. And I graduated, and then I did start university right after high school. Just kind of like general studies. And then once I did turn 18, my psychiatrist kind of did address the fact that, you know, I believe that this is your diagnosis, like borderline personality disorder. This is kind of what it is. I'm going to tell you, like, you know, there is a bit of a stigma around it. Hopefully that's not a lifelong thing. And also I'm going to tell you, like, we have tried many medications, but I don't think for this specific thing, there's one medication that's going to fix you, because I am a very obsessive person, you know, and I have been obsessed on like finding that perfect medication for my BPD before. And I've kind of had to accept that, like, there's been medications that have helped, and the medications I'm on now, like I'm functioning and doing, I'm stable, you know, but I was obsessed for a bit on like, where's the magic pill?
Right. And there isn't one. Yeah. Do you mind me asking what medications you're on right now? Like what's kind of working for you?
Zoloft.
Okay.
50 of Zoloft and Strattera for the ADHD. It's kind of
like a stimulant.
It's an add-on, but it's not a stimulant.
Okay.
So I found with the stimulants, and there's also like a history of a bit of like substance abuse, they were amplifying the OCD symptoms a bit, like my obsessions and stuff and my anxiety. So the Strattera has been like a little bit just taking the edge off and allowing me to like focus at work and stuff. And I'm also on Abilify 15 milligrams, which is another add-on.
So Zoloft is kind of your main drug right now.
Yes. Yeah.
And do you find that helps with the OCD symptoms as well?
I definitely do. Yeah.
Okay. What does that look like for you, the OCD symptoms, just out of curiosity?
Day to day, it's really, I guess, I feel I have a lot of obsessions. Like the rumination is big for me as well. I know there's even people here that have spoken on that before. I find that's really bad. I get hooked kind of like on like my paranoid thoughts in terms of how it like would overlap with my BPD. And I am overly like still somebody who is afraid of germs. Like I'll go in public and stuff, but I am a hand washer, you know, like my hands are pretty hard up. And they've been bleeding before because of it.
And does that come down to not wanting to get like the flu and then throwing up? Like, does it all tie back to that throwing up piece?
It is tied back to the throwing up piece. But I would say as well, there's health anxiety that underlies. My doctor actually, you know, has told me before, he's like, you're a bit of a hypochondriac. And I'm just like, I know, but.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
So what was COVID like for you then? Like really scary?
It was really hard.
Yeah.
It was really hard. It almost worsened. Like, I feel like I did make a lot of progress with my OCD specifically, but I do feel like COVID amplified it. Like recently I've been having to like, and since things have opened up again, having to force myself to go back out like restaurants and stuff and getting more comfortable, but I'm still feeling like it's lingering over me a little bit. And
totally.
I did have it and I wasn't that sick, but just being sick, you know, and germs is something that I do struggle with a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So pretty like classic OCD symptoms then, in terms of like what a lot of people think about when they think about OCD, which makes sense with the like fear of throwing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was missed for a while though, when I was a child and stuff, like, and I guess that's because I didn't really open up about the emetophobia. So it was missed for a bit. But in terms of the overlap with BPD, I also wanted to speak a little bit just on like my body image and the struggles with that as well. Like I've always been somebody who really loves makeup and stuff, but it's been to the point where like it's been a compulsion, and like I've been obsessed with having everything perfect, to my outfit, to, you know, the wing of my eyeliner. I've been in tears, redone it like over and over and over again. And also just like, you know, checking in the mirror, stuff like that. I can kind of see the pattern, and it's not just like, it feels like there's a bit more to it. Like I need to do these things.
Yeah, it's not just like you want to do them, but you actually like physically need to. Has that led to like eating disorder behavior and that kind of stuff?
I have struggled with actually disordered eating throughout, which my psychiatrist does say, you know, it's like part of the borderline personality disorder. There have been times when, well, my weight's been a lot, it's been up and down due to binging in certain points and then going the other way at other points. So yeah, I definitely think that correlates as well.
Yeah. So a lot of like obsession kind of overall, and then yeah, binge eating is a tough one for sure. Yeah. I feel like we're talking to the same people.
Waiting to see a dietitian for a while now, a year and a half, because of the fact that I'm kind of like a patterned eater as well. Like I'll only eat specific things that I know are like safe food, and certain amount of, you know, and yeah, I can become obsessive about that.
Does that also tie back to not wanting to throw up though, not trying new food? Because to me, that's a thing for me, is I'm like, well, I know that this food is not going to make me feel sick, so I'm just going to eat this food.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And it sucks because I'm like, everybody is out there like trying all this like new cool stuff. And I'm like, but I don't want to. I just want to try this because I know it's going to make me feel okay.
Absolutely. I take like the same foods for lunch most days and like eat the same foods. And then if there's like an event, you know, like that I have to go to lunch for, I'm anxious about it, worrying.
It's so interesting how much that like affects our lives. Hey, like, did you ever like bring bags and cups and stuff with you in your purse to like throw up into in case. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes. And yes, just to have them on me, dog poop bags and stuff.
Yeah, 100%.
And like the airplane thing and stuff, public transport, confined spaces just really bother me.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is like, I can't stand confined spaces, anything. Yeah. For that reason. Exactly. And it's funny, like my fear of flying is not because of like dying in a plane. It's because of throwing up in a plane. It makes no sense. Or absolutely. Having somebody else throw up in a plane.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you got a BPD diagnosis at 18, and it sounds like your psychiatrist was pretty good about like kind of explaining it to you. Had you heard of BPD before you got diagnosed?
I had. I'm a very big researcher, so I'd always been searching like, what is wrong with me? You know, why do I feel like an alien? And I'd read up a lot on just like the symptoms that I had, because again, like I say, you know, I graduated high school and I started university and I had a lovely psychiatrist, but I was still struggling. And I guess the research that I did and stuff kind of, it made sense and I was a bit aware of it. But also like just emotional dysregulation in general was brought up to me. So yeah, I was aware of it, but I also struggled with it a lot when I first got the diagnosis. And even just, you know, 18 onward is when I started to really go through relationship issues, and like, you know, trying to figure out what I was going to do and job transitions, medication transitions, and my substance use kind of did start after high school. So I guess it all kind of like made sense that the symptoms were the most prevalent then, and the diagnosis came at the time.
Yeah. And I mean, they're not supposed to diagnose you before 18 anyways, generally, right? So kind of all comes together. So what did the substance use look like in your life? Like, how did that affect you and your mental health?
Well, the substance use has been, I guess this is the other part of it. Benzos were, I'm allowed to talk about though that say that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, so totally.
They were always something that were available to me and pretty easily accessible or commonly used here in healthcare for people with mental health issues. So as long as I remember, I kind of had access to those and were prescribed them for immediate use. This kind of amplified when I started to struggle and my symptoms amplified, you know, as I became a young adult. And as well as other things, such as just like, you know, heavy marijuana use. And I'm talking about, you know, can't get up without it, can't eat without it. So I guess I was just trying to numb in any way that I could, but I never had an issue with alcohol, which is also pretty surprising to me because there is a pretty heavy family history and pretty directly as well. However, that fear and...
Yep, 100%.
It fully protected me. And I do feel like it could have been a serious issue had I not had that fear.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I think that's why I never was into drinking, is because I was like, you drink, you throw up. I'm not going to do that. I don't even want to be around that. And same with bulimia. I couldn't do it. So I think both, like, as much as it's been like a horrible experience to have that such an intense fear about something so small, it was definitely a protective factor for me.
Me as well. Yeah.
And this is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even now, you know, like I think back about it and I'm like, so many people around me always drink, you know, but I couldn't do it. But now when I started to numb with other things that then became a problem, but thankfully I have been working on that. I got treatment for that. And right now I am like sober. So that's an accomplishment in itself as well.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
And so the benzos were prescribed. Did you ever like go off, get non-prescribed benzos as part of your addiction?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, which is where it gets extra scary.
Absolutely. So that was kind of like a spiral, I'd say, between, you know, 18 to 24. they were rough years. I was living on my own, like in different houses. I was working different jobs. And, you know, I was kind of manipulating as well to get prescriptions. I didn't really see it as a problem because
prescribed.
I could go in public as well. But then I guess the symptoms came to a point where such heavy use hit me so hard that I did start to have some pretty paranoid thoughts. Yeah.
And is the like fentanyl crisis bad in Newfoundland?
It's not as bad as everywhere else.
Okay.
Surprisingly, but it does exist.
Right. So if you're taking like counterfeit benzos, there's still a risk.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's such a good example of like how the pharmaceutical industry makes people addicted, right? I've actually somehow, I don't know how, I've never been prescribed a benzo, never taken one, which is like very abnormal for people with BPD. And I'm so thankful because it's such a slippery slope for a lot of people. And then from what I've heard, like withdrawals are just unreal.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, when I talk a little bit more about that part of it, I guess, like the substance use, it is like the impact that it had on my symptoms and on just like my memory and things overall. It's pretty real stuff.
And what was treatment like for that? Like, were you an inpatient treatment?
I was, yeah, for 4 weeks. So Newfoundland has two options for adults. And I got in to the one that was closest to me. It's about an hour away from where I live in my family home.
Okay. Yeah. So that's not like too bad, but did it take a long time to get in?
It took about a year and a half.
Yeah. So like if your life is being like actively impacted by your use and like, you know, you were saying your memory, your paranoia, all these things, like a year and a half is a hell of a long time to be waiting.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we're very short-staffed here in terms of healthcare workers. It's pretty much a crisis right now. There are psychiatrists like that are leaving to go to private practices or elsewhere in the world. And the wait lists is like, I have friends that have been waiting 2.5 years to see a psychiatrist. And like, I know that they have pretty severe symptoms. I'm also aware it's not just Newfoundland, Canada. There's other places that are struggling as well. But yeah, I do know a good few people who I think their outcome could have been different. And I also know of people who have actually lost their battles because of the wait lists and the time it takes to get the care here.
Yeah. It's such a tragedy that the system doesn't work and that people do lose their battles because of not being able to access care. I think we have time to talk about that like in this episode. So why don't we get into it? So yeah. do you want to tell us a little bit about Newfoundland for the people that don't like aren't Canadian? We have listeners all over the world. They're going to have no idea what Newfoundland is and how they're unique and all that stuff.
Yeah. So like I said, we're an island. There's Newfoundland and Labrador. The population is again just under 525,000. I live on the east coast of the island. So over here, it's like the biggest population. And then there's like the west coast, which is a little bit smaller. So Eastern Health is where I would get my healthcare. That's my designated area. And then there's like Western Health. But overall, you know, there's a lot of small communities. There's a lot of, well, we're surrounded by ocean. So we're known for like the fishermen here and fishery. And there are still a lot of small communities and people that are fishermen. And that elderly population is also pretty large because of this. But where I'm living is as close I get I guess you'll get to a town setting. So I'm in St. John's, and our downtown is like pretty small, but yeah, it's I guess the city of it all.
Yeah, isn't it the capital?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I was like, I'm so bad at geography, but I'm pretty sure it's the capital.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it's just small overall then.
Yeah, it is small. And I find, you know, the people here are great. We're so kind. Like, people have been known for that, I guess, like, from what I've heard. But I do feel like we're a little bit further behind in the world, if that makes sense. Just because, I've been a part of the LGBTQ plus community here. And the experiences I've had with just like that feels like way different than, say, my sister who moved to Toronto, has been there for years. The way she describes it and the things I see when I do travel, it just, I'm like, I wish we could get a little bit further. And there has been progress. Yeah. But I guess it would be like that part, and then mental health in general. Mm-hmm. For example,
so you've got that kind of like small town problem, basically. Absolutely. which is funny, because like people from Newfoundland are so known for being so friendly, right? Like, I mean, like come from away, gander, like all of these things during 9/11. If you don't know that story, you have to look it up. It's beautiful. You know, just taking in people into their homes and like building all of these beautiful relationships with people. Like it's known for that. But I wonder, you know, if those are not necessarily the experiences of everybody that's living there, because it's that small town.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it does feel like everybody knows everyone, not just here, but across the island. So that's been heard. And I'm glad you did bring that up. And you said that you've heard that like people have said they're known to be kind, because I'm like, I hope people don't think that I'm
boning. No, it's a thing. I have seen Come From Away twice now, one time in New York and one time in Vancouver. And it is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I want to go to Newfoundland so bad just to like experience it. And also it's just like known for Canadians that A, you have funny accents, and B, you're very friendly people, and your accent's not that funny. I'm slightly disappointed. I can even understand you.
Oh yes. Yeah. If I was from around the Bay, it would be thick. I'll tell you that. Very funny.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. But yeah. And I'm actually going to see Come From Away in Gander this year. So.
Oh my God. Take a photo and send it to me. I'm probably going to cry just thinking about it. If you send me a photo.
I'm so happy that you know that and you're going, or you went, yeah. Sorry.
Oh yeah. I absolutely went. I love it so much.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a good place. The sights are beautiful. Lots of hiking, surrounded by water. I love being on the water. My dad has a boat, and it's a thing. It's kind of like a mindfulness activity for me. But yeah, it's just the suicide rate has increased a lot, I believe, due to lack of access to long-term mental health care. There have been people who protest, even like as of right now. There's people who protest weekly. They're
protest about the lack of care.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I was like, they're not protesting people getting care, right? That's terrible. Okay. Good.
Yeah. The lack of long-term care. And there have been like, so the main, I guess, place for mental health treatment is the Waterford Hospital here, and we do have two hospitals around in the eastern area. But the Waterford is the psychiatric based one. It's very, very old. And I don't know anybody who has had very positive experiences there, just again, because of the lack of beds and staffing, and a bit of stigma as well. You know, my personal experiences there there's been a lot of stigma towards my struggles and diagnosis. And I also have tried many times before I got treatment for substance use to get inpatient treatment, but it wasn't available here. Our other hospital that isn't the psychiatric one has a unit for psychiatric care. And I made a note because I just wanted to. We have a mobile crisis team here that work 9 to 4 Monday to Friday. So I found that that's a little bit restrictive, but it's also been helpful. And there is a suicide mental health crisis line that's 24 hours. But when I have called that, they've told me to go to the Waterford. The experience at the Waterford is that there's usually not very much space. They only have a certain amount of beds, and there are patients there that have been there like long-term. They may be up on trial or severely struggling. So there's also the general hospital. There's an emergency room mental health nurse that works 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. And then
because all mental health crises happen Monday to Friday, 9 to 5.
I know. And this is the thing, is because I'm like, every crisis that I've had has been like on the weekend or in the evening.
Of course it has. Yeah. You're not like being convenient. That's not the point.
No, they have 20 psychiatric beds in our main general hospital, and 4 of them are for eating disorder treatment. So the eating disorder treatment here is also a pretty big problem. There wasn't a foundation or even that designated unit until 2000, and I believe it was 2007. So wow. After the 2000s, and there was actually, there's a HOPE program now that's in memory of a girl, Renetta Withers. Her father basically like started it and is the reason that there is eating disorder treatment and a program here now, because she lost her battle. So I'm blessed because of my experience, but I do feel like I've experienced and seen so many people and heard of so many people and have friends that have struggled, are struggling, are waiting. And that part's really frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it sounds like once you've gotten, even when you do get in, you've experienced stigma and like not necessarily the best experiences. Do you want to share a little bit about what that's looked like for you?
Absolutely. So when I've gone to the Waterford, I've basically felt, because of the fact that I did have a safe place to go, such as, you know, I've always either lived with my family or had an apartment with a roommate or friend kind of thing, or a partner. And because I've always kind of had employment, I've been lucky in the sense of my employers have always been super accommodating and understanding. But immediately once they talk to me, they kind of are just like, I get the feeling like, why are you here? You know? And I understand that, like, I am a privileged person looking at the big picture. However, there have been times when I really could have lost my battle or life because of my mental illness, and I've not been taken seriously. I remember the last time I ever did go to the Waterford was before inpatient treatment, and I was really spiraling. It was bad. So I went down and I was just begging them to admit me, please, just like even for a couple of days, like I don't feel safe. Like, yes, my father's here with me, but like, I don't want him to have to be responsible to care for me. And the doctor there, the psychiatrist, was like aware that I had the BPD diagnosis. And he said, I will not be manipulated by somebody with borderline personality disorder, you know? And I lost it to the point where, you know, I'm somebody who's learned to keep my cool, but they threatened to call the cops on me if I didn't leave the hospital. And I was like, this is a mental health care facility. I'm begging you, and I'm upset because I want help. Like, I'm switching medications. I'm going through substance use. So that was hard.
And that's like direct stigma. Like, there's no like, I've heard a lot of people have experiences trying to get into hospital, and I've had the same experiences where they're like, well, it's actually not in your best interest to be in hospital because you have BPD. And it's like, okay, but I'm asking you to be, you know what I mean? Like, I'm asking for help and you're not giving me help. But to hear directly, like, I won't be manipulated, like, oh Lord, I would have slapped someone.
And I took out my phone too when I wrote it. I was so harsh because I was, again, I was in, that was a bad moment for me. It was a bad night. I was triggered, very much so, heightened. And I took out my phone and I remember I was like, I'm going to write this down. And I was like, and I hope that someday it gets quoted. Like, it, I was so mad.
Yeah, you have every right to have been mad. That is, I'm mad and I wasn't there. Like, that's so gross.
Yeah, yeah. And again, some have been great, but I think a lot of it is lack of education as well. Not lack of education, sorry, but like even the staff that were available 24/7 in the facility that I was in for treatment, they were just nurses and LPNs, and God love them. They were doing like a great job caring for us. But the other supports that we had, like there wasn't, and there never has been, the availability here to have like a one-on-one, even when I was an inpatient, even when I did DBT programs, you know, because there's just not enough resources. And the resources that we do have, I feel like aren't the best fit in some scenarios.
Yeah, like in a lot of situations, it's not necessarily the clinician's fault that the care isn't excellent. It's the system that they're in that means that they don't have the opportunity to provide the care that they want to provide. But that individual had stigma that was unnecessary, untrue, and absolute bullshit. So that's an example of like an individual problem as opposed to a systemic problem, which is like it takes 2.5 years to get treatment, or there's 4 beds for the entire province for eating disorders, right? Like you can separate those two things, but at the end of the day, that individual should not have ever said that and needed to like be reprimanded for it, hopefully.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So is there anything we haven't chatted about that you're interested in kind of bringing up?
There's probably always going to be stuff that I'm like, oh, I wish I said that. But I do feel like overall, like it's been a good chat. The only other thing that I guess I wanted to make a point of was just the marijuana, I guess, is something that I've also felt stigma towards in terms of not just healthcare professionals, but people who are also in treatment, which is kind of interesting, I think, because I haven't heard a lot of people that talk openly about it as an addiction, or at least not here anyway. But growing up and stuff, most people I knew smoked it, you know, daily or on the weekends since a very young age. And it can become such a problem. I really feel like it's something that isn't talked about enough. And even when I was in treatment, if it was brought up, or if there were other patients that came in and their only problem or issue was with marijuana, there would be so many comments from other people in there who were suffering with other things that they saw as more severe, you know. But I do think that there should be no stigma. Anything can become a problem or an addiction, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to even just be a substance, right? Like, I don't think people give food addiction the like seriousness that it requires. And in some ways, I think, I mean, I don't use substances, so I'm not going to pretend that I know what I'm talking about, but like the substances that are in front of you all the time, like marijuana, like alcohol, like food, those are really hard because like socially that's totally normal, right? To like, to do those things. Well, I mean, you have to eat. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that you don't have to eat, but like if you struggle with food addiction, it's really hard because you still have to eat, but you have to eat within, you know, certain constraints. And I'd be curious, like, did the legalization of marijuana change that perception in Newfoundland at all?
It very well may have. Yeah. There's been a large switch in terms of people's views about it. And just, you know, overall use and opinions. So that could have something to do with it as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that like in treatment, people were kind of considering it less severe. I feel bad for the people who that was their primary issue, right? Because yeah, like it can affect everybody totally differently.
Absolutely.
I feel like the final question I want to ask you is so random, so bear with me. Do you have any idea why you have such an intense fear of throwing up or other people throwing up?
I don't.
Me neither.
I've always wanted an answer. Because like I have, again, read up on it and done research, and people have had experiences where, you know, say they've seen a loved one before they've passed and they were throwing up. But I've never had anything like that happen. No.
Yeah, me neither. And I guess phobias often don't have like a reason, but it's just such a weird one. And like, it's so impactful into like both of our lives, it sounds like. So I was just like, maybe you have an answer that I haven't thought of. But yeah, I have absolutely no answer either.
Yeah. I was told once that like, it's something that is a loss of control. So it might have to do with the fact that, because in general, I am somebody who, I've been called a control freak, let's say, but yeah. So it might be about that. Like, I don't like not having control.
Yeah, but I think it's beyond that. I don't know. Yes, I can see where like, maybe that's part of it because you can't really control when you throw up, but like, that doesn't explain the other people throwing up issue.
Exactly.
So yeah, I think it's beyond that for me at least, but I still have never been able to put a reason behind it.
That makes me feel better though, because you know, I haven't either. And it's something that I've felt a lot of like confusion and shame about in the past. And I don't know why, I guess now, because phobia is a phobia, but yeah, it's so cool that we share this phobia.
It is. Yeah. I mean, like I don't wish it on anyone because it's so incredibly stressful and frustrating, but like it's significantly impacted my life in so many ways. And it sounds like it's done the same for you. And I love that you also were able to like recognize the protective factor of it, because sometimes I feel like I'm insane. I'm like, but actually this has been really good because of XYZ. So like, how do I balance this out? Anyways, fascinating. Thanks for validating me so much.
No, and me as well. It's nice to bond over it.
Totally. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Emily. It's been such a blast talking to you, and super, super excited to have you on the show. So yeah, hopefully you can come back another time, or if I'm ever in Newfoundland, I'll come hit you up.
Oh yes. Yes.
That would be amazing. I want to go so bad. It's just so expensive to get over there.
Oh yeah, it is. Yeah. It's something to see if you have the opportunity though, for sure.
Oh yeah. One day. Awesome. Thanks so much, Emily, and have a good one.
Thank you.
Hi friends. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline, and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.